Welcome back to True Crime San Antonio. I am just another San Antonio native, and thank you for tuning in. If you're new to the show, we cover crime from San Antonio, Texas exclusively. So it's been a few weeks. It's been a while, actually, and I find myself needing to apologize. I did not mean to take such a long break in between episodes. We weren't even close to being at the end of the season. I think I spoke briefly about how some things were changing in my life. And at this point, it was me burning the candle at both ends, and it took its toll. So it came down to something that I've talked about here before, but I've never really done for myself, and that's put my mental health first. Instead of forcing myself to overwork and rush to finish a story in time like I used to, and then beat myself down for making mistakes when I put that story out, I chose to take that time and give myself a chance to just relax and be me and be with my family. I was getting home late from work and immediately getting on the computer and researching and editing, and it was too much. And for me, my family is the most important thing. And the last thing I wanted to do was to make them feel like I was putting them on the back burner. Which none of them have told me they felt like, but still. So I took this time, this few weeks, almost 2 months, and I've worked on the show here and there, which is why we have a story today. But for the most part, I took that time for myself and for my family. I know for a fact I'm not alone in feeling overwhelmed and feeling like you have to do everything or nothing, and feeling like when you do everything that it's not enough. And if nobody has told you yet, let me tell you, it's okay. You're enough. You can put whatever it is off for another day, because sometimes it's better for us to do that than to drive ourselves into the ground. And I've done that time and time again. Being as stubborn as I am, and my wife knowing as stubborn as I am, she didn't push me to stop. She wanted me to get there on my own, and I did. And I think I can say for myself, I'm extremely proud that I was able to do that, because that was not easy. The first week, not putting a story out, I felt terrible. Felt like I was letting all of you down, letting myself down. The next week felt even worse. And then after that, I kind of started to ease up on myself and know that, hey, you know, the time that I am using, I'm not just sitting on my butt and doing nothing. I mean, I was working. I was doing a lot of things for myself, my family. My kid had a birthday, and that thing went off without a hitch. Not really, but it was still awesome. And I didn't even realize that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And it's something I think we should all be aware of, because I don't think there is one person in this world that doesn't have something that they're working with, something they're trying to get through, or don't even know that they need to get through something. And they could use someone to talk to and someone to tell them, hey, it's okay. And if you're out there and you need help, please reach out. If you know somebody who does, let them know. There is somebody that can help. Of that, I absolutely know without a doubt. So thank you to all of you who sent me messages and emails. No, I'm not ignoring any of you. I just needed a moment. All the messages I got of, hey, where you at? Hey, I have a story that I would like for you to do. All of those messages I read, they're awesome. All your ideas, they're great. And it's something that I'm definitely working on and definitely taking into consideration. Like I said, I did use some of that time to work on something for you today, and I'm very proud of it. This week's story is one that many San Antonians are familiar with. Maybe not the victim himself, but the gang, street, and gun violence, I'm sure. The tragedy of the drive-by shooting that ended the life of 4-year-old Raimundo Manuel Diaz. I do not have any San Antonio true crimes this week, mostly because I've been gone for 2 months and I didn't want to just cherry pick a few stories here and there to fill some time. I think if I do any of the stories that came through, I might do them in a full focus. And I might have to, because there is a new podcast that came out by a couple ladies that work for the KSAT 12 news team, and these girls are professionals. They're gonna put me out of business before I even get started. The podcast is called South Texas Crime Stories, and for the most part, they're covering mostly San Antonio stories, but some that have reached out even further, and I believe they're gonna do some that extend through most of South Texas. And to be honest with you, I love it. I think these girls are awesome. I know Lee Waldman is not from San Antonio, but I think Erica Hernandez might be, or at least she's from somewhere around here. You just hear it in her voice. She's taking over for the court reporting for the longtime reporter, Paul Venema, and I think she's doing an awesome job. Seriously, I think there's about 4 episodes right now out on their podcast, and I listened to the first 3, so I'm going to go listen to that 4th one soon. And yeah, they're doing some stories that I was going to do, and I'm going, man, I should have done it. But still, I'm psyched that they're doing this, because the reason I started my podcast was because I wanted to hear more stories from around here, from around where I grew up, and people that we knew. And that's exactly what they're doing. So, kudos to them. And I hope you give them a listen. South Texas Crime Stories. All right. I think we're good. Here we go. Episode 25. Warning, this story depicts accounts of violence and adult themes that may be found disturbing and unsuitable for some. Listener discretion is advised. The date was January the 30th, 1994. For some, it was just another Sunday, but for most, it was Super Bowl Sunday. Not only that, it was the Dallas Cowboys in the Super Bowl for the 2nd straight year. Maybe not a big deal for non-football fans, but here in San Antonio, where we don't have a pro football team, it was the Cowboys. Parties were going down everywhere in the city, and also at the Romero House on the 1800 block of Arboleda Street, on the inner west side of San Antonio. 4-year-old Ramundo Manuel Diaz enjoyed a day out with his 2-year-old brother, 8-month-old sister, his mom Barbara, and grandmother Irene, eating pizza and playing as a happy kid would. They got back to the house and awaited the game to start. Kickoff was just after 5 p.m. that night, and the sun would set about an hour later. By halftime, the Cowboys were losing, but things at the Romero House were about to get worse. At around 8:30 p.m., shots rang out, but nothing was hit. Irene and her 15-year-old son Manuel went outside to the backyard to inspect, but found no signs of damage or anyone around. They went back inside to watch the game, but Barbara decided it was time to leave and started collecting hers and her children's things. 20 minutes passed. A gray car was spotted slowly driving through the area and turned the corner. Moments later, a volley of 5 shots split the night air. Everyone inside the home scrambled to find a safe place, and most headed for the bathroom. Someone tried to grab 4-year-old Ray, but couldn't. When it was over, Barbara looked at her son standing against a wall. "I looked to see if he was okay," she said. He had his eyes crossed to one side, but he was smiling. Then she saw the blood on his head and laid him down. He started crying and said, "It hurts, Mommy." One of the bullets pierced through the back sliding glass door and struck the preschooler in the head. They frantically dialed 911 and awaited EMS, hoping little Ray could just hold on. Unfortunately, at 11:14 p.m. that evening at University Hospital,
4-year-old Raimundo Manuel Diaz was pronounced dead. The Cowboys would come back to win that game, but what did it matter at that point? The headline in the San Antonio Express News the next morning read, "Family outraged at Tot's slaying." Relatives questioned at the scene believed the attack may have been gang-related and that another home in the block had been shot up nearly a dozen times over the last year. At the time of the shooting, Barbara and little Ray were still mourning the death of her husband, his father, who was shot to death in another drive-by shooting on March 26, 1993. But according to police, no links were reported between the two shootings. The family was outraged. They were outraged that firing into homes continued and that assailants were seldom caught. Ray's grandmother Irene said as she wiped tears running down her face that night, "We're losing our children. We're losing our babies." She recalled her last outing with the boy. He had a good time. He enjoyed himself. He laughed. She described him as such a good baby. He was always happy. She said she felt nothing but anger in the wake of her grandson's senseless death. "You can't run from it. It's everywhere," she said. "They are just doing it because they know they won't be caught. And if they are, nothing happens because they're juveniles." The shooting death of the 4-year-old occurred about 24 hours after another young child was gunned down in her mobile home in the 7300 block of New Sulphur Springs Road. 7-year-old Adriana Arevalo and her father, 57-year-old Ruperto Arevalo, died when their home came under attack by semi-automatic rifle fire at about 8:30 p.m. the night before. Their killers would be found and convicted. They were juveniles. 3 days later, on February the 2nd, 1994, little Ray was laid to rest at San Fernando Cemetery No. 2. More than 100 family members and friends gathered at San Martin de Porres Catholic Church to pay last respects. The Reverend Gilbert Oben said in his homily, "It's a shock beyond comprehension that a thing like this could happen," and added, "The youth is now in the hands of God. We don't have to worry and be sad for Raimundo, but we have to worry about what our society is doing to itself," the priest said. The city was coming off a record year in which 229 murders were recorded, of which 27 of those were drive-by shootings in 1993. Little Ray now shares his plot with his cousin, Brea DeShay Bearfield. She was a few months shy of her second birthday. "I saw that and thought, please don't have let her live the same fate." No, she didn't. The pictures I found of her showed a happy baby, loved by her family. Happy, but clearly suffering from an illness that would ultimately take her life. Being the curious one, as I always am, I looked up her family. Her mother was little Ray's aunt. I found a case where her uncle, Jeremiah Bearfield, was sentenced to life in prison in 2014 for the 1997 murder of 31-year-old Kimberly Coleman. A DNA match to Bearfield from a Kansas City Chiefs hat left at the scene of the 402 Lounge, and another man who turned himself in led to his arrest. When Bearfield was sentenced to life, he broke down crying and claimed they obtained his confession illegally. His mother was asked to leave the courtroom, outraged as she claimed his innocence and that it was his brother Chris who did the shooting. Tragically, unfortunately, and maybe coincidentally, Christopher Bearfield was shot to death in July of 2008. He was 29. His killer was never caught. Back to our story. 2 days later, on February the 2nd, 1994, San Antonio police were called to Brentwood Middle School after a 14-year-old student confided to his teacher that he had participated in a drive-by shooting. School authorities notified the Edgewood Independent School District's police department and the student's mother. mother and student were in Principal Marquez's office when Edgewood Officer Regina Reed arrived. If you went to school in the Edgewood Independent School District in the last few decades, you probably knew her as RoboCop. A proud, tall, black woman whose mere presence would stop you in your tracks if you even thought about getting out of line. I once saw her break up a fight and toss two students around like ragdolls. She was tough and mean, if you got on her bad side, but she was cool too. Her dedicated hard work would earn her the Alamo Area Council of Governments Age Out Loud Lifetime Commitment Award in 2017. She unfortunately passed away from lung cancer in 2019 though. I don't mean to get away from the story at hand, but not to mention RoboCop would be a complete disservice to her. So, Officer Reed and Edgewood Officer Pilar Mireles talked with Principal Marquez about the student's confession and then contacted the San Antonio Police Department. Then, Detectives Roland Casillas and Larry Ripley of the San Antonio Police Department arrived and explained to the mother that they were investigating her son's involvement in a drive-by shooting. Both she and her son were asked to come to the police station for questioning. It's there, inside Supervisor Detective Moffitt's office, not an interrogation room, that the 14-year-old told him he wanted to stay and tell them what had happened. That he had been sick and unable to sleep since the shooting. He was clearly upset, ashamed, and asked that his mother not know of his participation in the shooting. The teenager then gave a 4-page written statement wherein he confessed to being the shooter and named a friend who participated in the shooting. He was charged with engaging in delinquent behavior with the underlining offense of capital murder and remained at the Bexar County Juvenile Detention Center until a judge could decide if there was enough evidence to keep him behind bars. The next day, the friend was arrested after the parents of the 14-year-old brought him into the police station and was turned over to juvenile authorities, also facing charges of delinquency involving capital murder. Four months later, in July of 1994, the names of the two teenage boys were printed in the paper as their trials were about to start in the 285th District Court. Michael Rodriguez Rubio Jr. and Larry Arevalo would be the first defendants in the state to be tried under a new law passed in September of 93 that made it a capital crime to kill a child under the age of 6. Lawyers and lawmakers around the state would be watching the case as it tested the law designed to offer small children greater protection in an increasingly violent society, according to then Senator Buster Brown, who sponsored the legislation in the Senate. Senator Brown said the boys' trial would be precedent-setting, and that if there was a conviction, it would probably be appealed. According to the senator, when the law was written, it was aimed primarily at victims of child abuse, adding that he was told that 70% of the children who die as a result of abuse are under the age of 6. Today, that law has been raised to the age of 10. If the teens were adults, they would have been facing the death penalty for capital murder. However, since they were both 14, they were legally juveniles and too young to even be tried as adults. So prosecutors Michael Ramos and Tilden Schaefer were trying the teens under the Determinate Sentencing Act, which requires juveniles to serve their sentences at a youth correctional facility before being transferred to a state prison as adults. Under that act, the maximum sentence the teens could face was 40 years. The defense lawyers for the teens was Edward Bartolome and Richard Acevedo. They said they expected the trial to last 2 weeks. Testimony would begin a couple days later on Friday, July the 8th, as prosecutors would bring to light both of the teenagers' confessions. In the now 15-year-old Larry Arevalo's confession, known to some as Tiny, he would tell police that he was the driver of the car and implicated Rubio as a gunman in the shooting. In the confession read to jurors Arevalo said a fellow gang member delivered a sawed-off AK-47 to his house, telling him to keep it because it was too hot from being used in drive-by shootings. Arevalo said in confession that it was Rubio's idea to shoot up the house in the 1800 block of Arboleda Street because a 15-year-old rival gang member who lived there had been messing with the girlfriend of one of Rubio's fellow gang members. That rival gang member he was referring to was Little Ray's uncle, Manuel Romero. Arevalo said in his statement that Rubio opened fire on the house, but thought he missed, so the pair drove by again 20 minutes later and fired upon it again. Both teens just lived blocks away from the Romero house at the time. Prosecutors allege it was one of those bullets that killed Little Ray Diaz. "I didn't shoot that little boy," Arevalo said in his statement. "I didn't mean for him to get shot. I'm sorry, but I know that it won't bring him back. It was all over a color of your set. It ain't worth it." Michael Rubio Jr.'s confession read, "After we got done eating, me and my friend went back to his house. When we got to his house, he got a rifle. I don't know where he had it because I stayed in the car. When we went to his house, I think it was just his mother, brother, and sister at home. I don't think they saw him with a rifle because he went out through the bedroom window with a rifle. When he went into the house, he went in through the front door. When he came back to his car, he told me to scoot over and he told me, 'You're the one that wants to do it,' so he gave me the gun. And it was a rifle. And it was like wood on the part where you grip and stuff. I think it's a Chinese gun because it looks like a hunting gun. The gun didn't have any clip in it. It didn't have any bullets in it when he gave it to me. I had never seen the gun before and it was the first gun I ever used. He was driving and I was in the passenger seat. We talked about how to do the shooting and he said, 'Let's do it through the back.' While he was driving, I started loading the gun. I put in 7 bullets. I don't know what kind of bullets they were, but they were real long. The gun has a lever that you have to load each bullet after you shoot. He drove from his house to the front of the house that we hit to see if anybody was home. We were just looking to see who was there, and we saw some people's shadows walking inside the house. Then he drove to the back of Dahlgreen and stopped the car, like in the back of the house, but we were still on the street. I sat on the side of the door with the top part of me out of the car. My friend kept the car running so we could get out of there fast. When I was sitting on the door, I had to shoot over the top of the car to shoot at the house. Then my friend drove a little bit more to the front, and then I shot 2 more times. On those last 2 shots, I was aiming at the sliding glass door. I didn't hear nothing, and I didn't know if I hit it or not. Then he just drove off and turned the lights on. We had the lights off when I was shooting. He drove back to his house, and he took the gun and went back to his window and went inside. Then he came back out and he drove the car back to my aunt's house. Me and my friend went inside and I just started crying. He said, 'You're just like that because it's your first time.' We just stayed there for about 10 minutes and then I told him I had to go home and I drove him back to his house. On the way to my friend's house, he told me not to say anything to anybody, to nobody, or else our asses are going down." Rubio had also told police that Manuel Romero had threatened to shoot up his home. The reality of the death was brought into the courtroom Friday by the 4-year-old's mother, 23-year-old Barbara Romero. She maintained her composure on the witness stand until prosecutors showed her a photograph of her son. She then broke down and sobbed uncontrollably. District Judge Michael Pettin had to call a 5-minute recess to allow Barbara to regain her composure so she could continue answering questions. She testified she and her 3 children, Raimundo the oldest, were at her mother's house on Arboleda Street watching the Super Bowl when they heard what they thought were firecrackers. She recalled the scene and laying down her dying son after he spoke his last heartbreaking words of pain. Court would break for the weekend and return on Monday. On that day, a scared 14-year-old girl speaking in a soft voice, told jurors that Michael Rubio Jr., whom she had known since grade school, confessed to her that he had killed a 4-year-old in a drive-by shooting. Before the girl took the witness stand, District Judge Bethan called members of the media to the bench and asked that the girl's name not be reported because prosecutors feared for her safety. The girl testified Rubio called her the day after the shooting because she was having a birthday party. She said he sounded sad. I asked him what was wrong, the girl testified. He told her they killed a 4-year-old. The girl testified Rubio sounded like he was crying when he told her he and Arevalo killed the 4-year-old in a drive-by shooting by accident. The pair was aiming at another 14-year-old, Ray's uncle, Manuel. The pair was aiming at Manuel, who lived at that house because he'd been talking to Rubio's girlfriend. It differed from Arevalo's confession of it being another gang member's girlfriend, but still similar. Detective Roland Casillas testified that Rubio had confessed to a teacher that he was responsible for the boy's death. Also testifying on that Monday was Little Ray's grandmother, Irene Romero. She cried as she told jurors she remembered Ray standing by a table in the living room, arranging small plastic toys that he had just gotten from a pizza parlor. Moments later, the small boy was shot in the head by a bullet that shattered a sliding glass door in her home. Irene sobbed as she described how she cradled her dying grandson, promising to buy him a swing set and the puppy he always wanted if he would just live. The judge had to call another recess in the trial so she could compose herself as she wept over the photo of her grandson, tenderly touching the picture and said, "That's my baby, Ray, my grandson." Despite Rubio's and Arevalo's confessions that were read to jurors, the parents of each boy testified that their respective sons were home at 9 p.m. and after that evening. The 911 emergency call about the shooting came in just after 9 p.m. and they only lived a couple blocks away. It would have taken them less than a minute to get home. Defense attorneys for the teens rested their case Friday afternoon without calling either boy to the stand. And when the verdict came back on Monday, July the 18th, the jury found both Rubio and Arevalo guilty of capital murder. When the punishment phase of the trial started the next day, educator Lorna Cloganga testified that after the kids leave elementary school and go to middle school, it's typical that they give in to peer pressure and join gangs. "From what the kids have told me, it's a survival tactic," she testified. Lorna was the vice principal of Gardendale Elementary School when Rubio and Arevalo attended the school. "I put Michael at the top of the list when it came to good kids," she said. She also testified that Arevalo had discipline problems at school. He had been in trouble for fighting and was considered learning disabled and emotionally disturbed. James Sherman, the county psychologist assigned to the juvenile detention center, testified that Arevalo also had a problem with substance abuse and used marijuana, cocaine, LSD, and alcohol. He also testified that Rubio used marijuana and alcohol. Prosecutor Mike Ramos and Tilden Schaefer attempted to get into evidence a letter Rubio wrote in which he admitted carrying out another drive-by shooting. However, District Judge Pettin ruled that it was not admissible and that the jurors were not permitted to read it. Defense attorneys Ed Bartolome and Richard Acevedo presented witnesses who said the teen should be rehabilitated. Although Acevedo hinted in questioning that the probation might be sufficient, even his client's mother said the boy needed to be punished. Patricia Arevalo testified, "I want him to go to TYC, the Texas Youth Commission, because if he did this like you all say he did, he should be punished." Even with all that, Larry Arevalo was overheard in the courtroom telling Michael Rubio that they'd get probation. The defense attorney told jurors during the closing statement that the teens were victims of their environment and reminded jurors that defense witnesses said many teens on the West Side joined gangs to survive on the streets. "This is a reality for these children," Bartolome told jurors. He also told him not to lose sight of Rubio Nadevalo and their families, who also have suffered because of the crime. When you assess punishment in this case, you think about Michael Rubio the same way you think about the victim, he said. The attorney argued that Rubio did the shooting because he had been told his house was targeted for a drive-by. He was threatened, and no one sitting here can tell you different, he said. The question is, how do we handle it? How do we punish? How do we rehabilitate? The prosecutors reminded jurors of Little Ray's last words during closing arguments in the punishment phase of the trial. What were his last words? He asked the jury. Mommy, it hurts. Mommy, it hurts. So please remember that before you decide what his life was worth, Ramos told the jurors. The jury, consisting of 8 men and 4 women, deliberated for about an hour before assessing the maximum penalty of 40 years. They could have assessed probation if they believed it had been warranted. They chose not to. As the law stood then, the pair would have to serve at least 20 years before becoming eligible for parole. However, because they are juveniles and will begin serving time in a Texas Youth Commission facility, their sentence will be reviewed by a judge before they reach the age of 18. At that time, each could be sent back to the TYC, paroled outright, or sent on to prison. When the sentence came down, 15-year-old Larry Arevalo smirked, while 14-year-old Michael Rubio Jr. hung his head and said, "I'm sorry for what I did." Little Ray's family hugged each other and wept in the courtroom. Outside in the hall, Ray's grandmother Irene said through her tears that she hoped the stiff sentence would be seen as a warning to other wayward youths. "Maybe the 40-year maximum will make other kids think twice before going and doing a drive-by shooting. I think this will probably help other kids." Arevalo told reporters in the hall, "It wasn't us." Defense attorney Bartolome said he'd consider appealing the case, but said he was unsure if he would contest the new law as part of the appeal. As it turned out, the capital murder convictions would be reversed on appeal almost 3 years later. The conviction was reversed and the youths were sent back for a new trial in March of 1997 because court records did not reflect that they were fully made aware of their rights and the consequences of the charges against them. The state presented almost the same case against the two defendants, then both 17 and still considered juveniles. This time, they made sure the court records reflected they were fully aware of their rights and the consequences of the charges against them. The state called a witness who was with Rubio and Arevalo that night, a witness that I don't believe they had the first time around. It was this witness's house that proved to be the departure point for the two young men on that night of the shooting. The witness testified that Rubio was mad at Manuel Romero, a rival gang member and uncle of the victim. The witness also testified that Rubio was considering capping Romero, that Rubio left the witness's house and returned with Arevalo. The three of them snorted cocaine at the house and discussed doing a drive-by shooting of Romero's house. While at the house, the witness stated that they were going to get a gun. The boys left the house for approximately 15 to 20 minutes, and the witness testified that during the time the boys were gone, the witness heard shots in the neighborhood. When the two returned, they were looking nervous and hyper. Rubio entered through the back of the house and Arevalo stood at the bedroom window with a rifle. The witness testified that they thought the rifle was an AK, and that both boys stated they had shot at Romero's house. In addition, the witness stated that Arevalo drove and Rubio conducted the shooting. The boys left a second time stating that they were going to check on the house. They returned a second time looking hyper and nervous. Both boys said they had shot at the house again, and according to the testimony, the witness gave the boys a shirt to hide the rifle. At trial, the witness was asked to examine a Norinco Mag 90 recovered by Detective Moffitt and submitted into evidence by the state. The witness testified that the gun was similar to the one they had seen the night of the shooting. The witness also testified that they had seen a similar rifle at Arevalo's house about a month before the shooting. Although extensive, the witness's testimony contained some gaps. The witness admitted to not hearing gunshots when the boys left for the second time. It was this second drive-by shooting, according to the record, which led to the shooting death of Raimundo Diaz. Secondly, the witness did not see what the boys did with the gun after they gave the boys a shirt. However, the witness did testify about receiving phone calls from both boys the next day, and Arevalo called to tell the witness that Manuel's nephew had been shot. According to police records, Rubio and Arevalo were a part of the STP gang, also known as the Satan Posse. Other evidence at trial included the testimony of a fellow Satan Posse gang member. He testified on the night of the shooting he had gone to Arevalo's house seeking protection. Arevalo removed what appeared to be a rifle from a hole in his bedroom wall that was wrapped in his shirt. The two boys then took the rifle to the house of another friend, where Arevalo exchanged the rifle for a pistol. The pistol was given to the friend seeking protection. The admission of Rubio's statement was followed by testimony of ballistic expert Robert Stengel. At the time of his testimony, Stengel was retired. However, he had worked as a firearms and tool marks examiner for 23 years. During that time, he had worked for the San Antonio Police Department for 11 years and for the County Medical Examiner's Office for 12 years. As an internal ballistics expert, Stengel's expertise centered on what would happen inside a gun when shots were fired. In this case, he testified pursuant to his report admitted into evidence, which documented his findings on evidence obtained by investigators. Stengel analyzed spent cartridge casings, bullets, and bullet fragments. Test results from his analysis were admitted into evidence, and Stengel was asked to determine whether the cartridge casings, bullets, and bullet fragments were fired from the same gun, and whether they were fired from a particular gun. With regards to bullet fragments, Stengel determined that two bullet fragments had been fired from the Renko Mag 90 recovered by police. In addition, he determined that six cartridge casings were fired from the same weapon. Stengel also conducted tests duplicating the firing of shots through glass as it had occurred the night of the shooting. The purpose of the test was to determine whether the shots were fired from a long or short distance. From this test, he determined that the shots came from about a distance of 100 yards. He further confirmed, based on bullet holes found in the house, that the shots came from the back of the Romero house. In its closing statement, the state relied on all the evidence and testimony to sustain a true verdict. It even reminded the jury of the limited purpose of the confessions by stating that each confession should only be used against the confessor. After the defense made their closing statement and where they pled for leniency, their state rebutted with, "They are there, they are detailed, and the confessions were taken before all the facts of the crime were in. Remember that when you're going over those confessions, because the confessions will tell you everything you need to know." And they were obtained by the police a few days after the crime, before the ballistics evidence came in, before the gun was even located. The witness with the boys that night gave a statement to the police very soon after the defendant's confessions, and they corroborated everything they say in their confessions. And their confessions corroborate everything they told you all. And that's really all you need in this case. The ballistics, the confessions, the testimonies of two witnesses, and that's all you need. A 7-woman, 5-man jury deliberated about 4 hours over 2 days before returning the true verdicts against Michael Rubio Jr. and Larry Arevalo. Immediately after the verdict, juries began hearing the state's case in the punishment phase of the trial. Counselors at the Giddings State School, where the teens had been assigned for the previous 3 years, said both men had been courteous, remorseful, and had shown progress towards rehabilitation. The defense attorneys called the shooting a horrible mistake made by otherwise good kids and said the teens were very remorseful for the killing. Assistant District Attorney Angus K. McGinty told jurors that the two waited for sirens to signal they had shot someone after firing at the victim's house. They waited to hear a wailing siren so they could be happy they killed someone. And when they didn't hear it, they got depressed and went back again, he said. They asked the jury to set an example that murder is the most serious offense, despite the age of the killers. ADA McGinty said the teens made a string of bad decisions, seeking out a gang to join, using drugs and alcohol, acquiring weapons, then shooting at the home. Make them pay for that choice, he told the jury. They aren't sorry they shot at the home. They're only sorry that it was a 4-year-old that was killed. During final arguments, Little Ray's grandmother, Irene, burst into tears and left the courtroom. Having to relive the memories cradling her grandson as he was dying was just too much. On Wednesday, March 26, 1997, the jury assessed a maximum penalty of 40 years for the death of 4-year-old Ramundo Manuel Diaz to Michael Rubio Jr. and Larry Arevalo. This time, both boys were expressionless and silent. Ray's grandmother Irene said, "We shouldn't have had to go through this twice." She clutched hands with family members, crying and smiling as the sentences were read. "Now my grandson can rest in peace and we can get on with our lives," she said. District Judge Frank Montalvo was to reassess their progress in the juvenile facilities and decided to either release the teens or transfer them to adult prisons when they turned 18. He did exactly that. As far as I know, both teens served their minimum of 20 years. I was told by a source that Michael Rubio Jr. got out a few years ago. It would have been 20 years in 2014 with time served. And I found his social media. It looks like he's living his life. Married, new baby. I'm happy he found a way to live with himself. Some people can't, or completely forgive themselves for what happened. I don't know. He was only 14 when he made those life-altering decisions. And kids make stupid mistakes every day. But the choice to take a life, no matter why, is not an easy one to make or to forgive. I don't know what happened to Larry Arevalo. He wasn't smiling during the second trial. I guess 3 years in confinement would do that to anybody, I guess. Putting this story together wasn't easy. I could have chosen any one of the 1,000 drive-by shootings to cover in San Antonio over the last 30 plus years. I chose Little Ray's story because I grew up 2 blocks from him. Had he lived, he would have gone to the same schools I did: Gardendale, Brentwood, Kennedy. The field that Rubio shot across to hit their house is where we played ball. I spent so many days there before and after that night. I wondered why I didn't remember this story. I wasn't home that night because we had attended a Super Bowl party on the south side, and I'm sure my mom wasn't about to tell me that little boy was shot to death down the street. We didn't know them. I asked my brother if he remembered, and right away he rattled off all the names I had just been reading. For years, I knew my brother ran with some bangers from the street, but I didn't. I was never even approached by them. I never knew why. I never questioned it. Even feeling left out, if you could imagine. He finally told me that when I turned 11, they asked him if I was ready to join. My brother told this grown man to keep me out of it and got his ass whooped for it. The naiveness of my young self thinking the streets weren't that hard. Gangbangers just leave you alone if you left them alone. If I only knew. Another source told me about his run-ins with Michael and Larry. He contradicted what Rubio claimed to be the motive for the shooting. He also laughed when I read Rubio's confession to him. First time shooting a gun? Nah, he was a banger just like me. He recalled getting shot at while hanging out with friends in the neighborhood and remembers Rubio being in the car that shot at them. No one died, but his friend had caught some pellets from a shotgun blast to the back. He said Michael and Larry were Black Rags, aka STP. Emmanuel and him were TT boys. Our streets had their own cliques, from the D Street Thugs, A Street Thugs, and so on. He had a truce with Rubio from Violence on the Block because they lived close to one another, but that meant nothing when they ran into each other elsewhere. He said that Rubio and him got in a gunfight once on the street, but no one was hit. He said the reason Rubio shot Emmanuel's house at night had nothing to do with the girl. He said a few days before the shooting, they had a brawl that STP was on the losing end of. The words he used was, "We beat the fuck out of them." He said they were bitter and went after Manuel because of it. He said the Romero family moved out soon after and he never heard from Manuel again. Manuel, I looked him up. He's currently serving 4 years in the TDC for multiple drug charges over the years. Made me wonder if his drug use came from survivor's guilt. I could only imagine the pain he felt knowing those bullets were meant for him. I found not one picture of Little Ray online, so I visited his grave. It's how I found out that he's now sharing his plot with his cousin. It was nice finally getting to see his face. He looks happy in the picture on his headstone. He turned 4 on December the 23rd. Christmas baby. He didn't get a chance to live, to love, to make his own mistakes, to learn from them. I was happy knowing that his last day on earth was spent having fun with his family and playing with his toys. Probably plying for the attention of everyone while standing in front of the TV during the game. Rest in peace, Ray. If you're a fan of the show, show your love with a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to help us grow. Let me know your thoughts on Instagram at True Crime San Antonio. We'd love to hear from you. Truly. This has been True Crime San Antonio, and I am just another San Antonio native, hoping to see us through. Take care.